Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Ed Milantech podcast. I am one of your hosts, Dr. Matt Stranick, and with me, as always, is my esteemed, awesome, excellent colleague. That's you, bud.
Oh, Dr. Doug Green.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just got lost with all those wonderful modifiers and stuff.
Superlatives. If that was written down on paper, I would go, this is not well written, but the joys of the spoken format, you know, and or video format.
Absolutely.
Okay, and I just want to take a quick moment here, just because I am here in the unceded traditional territory of the Shequetmic people here in the heart of Shequetmic Ulu, Kamloops, where teaching and learning have been taking place since time immemorial. And actually, I just want to say that Doug and I have been trying to come up with a better way to do the acknowledgments. I think this may be the last time we sort of do the extemporaneous approach here. We may come up with something a little bit more professional. I don't want to say canned acknowledgement because that sounds wretched, but something maybe a little bit with a little bit of production value on it, and we're going to have it at the beginning. And that will kind of set us up each episode going forward. Is that a reasonable summary of what we were talking about there towards the end, bud?
Yeah. So I'm coming from traditional Mi'kmaq territory on the east coast of Canada. And for me, I'm not looking for more professionalism. I want to make sure I don't make a mistake and sound disrespectful, because that's not.
There we go.
I'm doing is very heartfelt. I don't want to muck it up.
Yeah, no, that's way better. I was using a catchphrase to say something, and you were having a very thoughtful thought on top of that. So I guess, FYI, there's always change on the show, and we're going to be moving that aspect of the format into further directions, because as Doug says, it's very meaningful, it's very important, and we want to make sure we're doing it to the full benefit of both what we're capable of in this format, but then also with, you know, the ultimate respect to, you know, the First Nations and, you know, the groups and individuals who were here for thousands of years before us. We really want to make sure that we're given the proper credit for that. So, Doug, let's just get down to the brass tacks, dude. You had a very interesting topic, and I'm curious as to why. You want to just hit us up here? I'll let you read the topic, man, because it's pretty dope to settle for this, I gotta say.
Okay, so the topic we came up with was Veritas, dealing with reality in education. And what happened was I spent a week in Cuba. So that's why we didn't do anything last week. We took a break, and wasn't that wonderful? And I came back full of energy and thought, oh, I'm going to be super analytical and super academic, and what's the Latin word for reality, which happens to be Veritas? That's where that came from. And one of the things I went looking for in Cuba was books to learn more about Cuban history, because we've got our version of stuff here, and I wanted to get the local version. And the problem is most of the books that I found were
Nothing about the Bay of Pigs. I'd be interested to know what the Cuban missile crisis looked like, you know, from the Cuban point of view, if you will.
There was about, all in of all the places we went, there was about 7 different books in English, and 6 of them were about Che Guevara.
Is there like a huge monetized Che Guevara, like, cult of industry now, in terms of just, you know, is he like slathered around the all over the place? Is he considered a folk hero, you know, father of the nation, nothing like that? I have no clue how this stuff goes.
Yeah, I think like a father, a guiding force of the nation, yes, but not monetized, right? Because they have pushed capitalism off. They're as monetized as this podcast is right now.
Okay. Well, I mean, you were staying at the all-inclusive resort, right? I mean, that was kind of where you were based out of.
I've never done that before, and I needed.
Good for you.
I wanted a different experience, because my experiences are go someplace, wander around, see what there is to see, have adventures. And this was different. This was, hey, can you relax? Can you chill out? Can you just sit? I read two books. It was awesome.
Which two books did you read, Doug?
Tarzan of the Apes by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Dope. And The Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman.
Oh, wow. I have the Gaiman?
I thought it was Gaiman.
I don't think I've even heard anybody else pronounce his name besides me. So, yeah, okay, Gaiman. I've got that book. I've got that book in my friggin' endless to-be-read pile over there. Well, that's cool, man. So you had to unlearn your stressful workaday, whatever kind of habits that you're in. And you met with some success in that regard, I hope.
Oh, yeah. I learned tons of stuff.
Okay.
I learned how many rum punches are okay to have in an afternoon and how many is too much.
I would have lost count. See, I'd just be blacked out in a puddle, just, however many was that, I'll just have one less,
That's exactly the math.
I'd be refining my technique all the way through, right? In terms of consumption. But of course, I'm never going to be in that situation. I can't believe you've gone this far into your career and you're just doing that now. That's awesome, man.
That wasn't my life. My life was, let's go see stuff. Let's go adventure.
Right.
Go find. And I got to say, it's kind of nice to wander to that same building all the time and the food's just there. Right, that is outside the scope of my experiences, but
all service model, yeah. Well, before we start thinking about actually running away to Cuba, okay, so Veritas, dealing with reality and education, and I guess I just say in terms of where I've been coming from, because you've been reading these quite varied books, and you've got these sources here written in this topic. I'm super impressed because you're on your vacation week or just coming off of it, and you've managed to, I'm glad you relaxed, but the outputs here are more than what you would normally get from, somebody who's ostensibly on vacation. But, for me, just in terms of what I've been up to, I've had some kind of career things that I'm sort of trying to steer myself towards. It's a long weekend, right? It's a stat holiday across Canada. Family Day? That's not just a BC thing?
They call this Islander Day here.
Oh, I see. But so it's like a local, whatever you want to call it, holiday. Is that the idea?
Do you know where that started? Do you want some useless information?
We may as well go down that rabbit hole, man. Let's do it.
Okay. Late 80s, early 90s, in Alberta, the premier's son got caught with some kind of drugs. I think it was cocaine.
Dang.
And in front of the judge.
Are we making like.
No, before Lougheed? It might have been Lougheed. And basically, the judge said there's a lack of family values in this province. We need to deal with that. And then the government's like, okay, we're going to address that. So that's where Alberta got Family Day. That's where they added that February stat holiday.
Okay.
So if it's called Family Day in BC too, they just copied Alberta.
We just ported it over. Okay. Well, that's I wouldn't say that's useless. That's some good context there. Thanks for helping.
I'm the
fill
one
that
off
in.
Topic today.
Oh,
I'm
no,
off
man.
Topic
that's fine.
On you today. So
no, man. That's fine. That's fine. Just in terms of remaining on topic, I've got some things that I've been reading, but maybe we'll just sort of plug that in a little bit later. I'll just sort of come up, speak to it as it comes up. I do like here this quote that you have. Initially, the schools in this country were established to transmit beliefs conducive to right conduct and successful, quote, industry here. So that's from your Walsh and Paul source. And this is like, that's an old thing, right? That's a 1986 source. So I guess, first of all, kudos to you for going that far back to find something that resonates pretty strongly still, I would say.
Well, that's what I was, when I was in Cuba, looking around for stuff, I'm like, what is going on? How do we what are we doing? What are the realities we're actually dealing with? Because I had my own, grew up, and this is what Cuba was. And now that narrative has changed. And I thought, how does this apply to something in education? Because I'm trying to learn more.
Yep.
And then I am, like, I was in high school when that article got published. So taking a look, like, why were schools set up? And, okay, so it's about industry and appropriate conduct. So what are we doing? What's the realities of schools today? And that's where I wanted to come from, to find out what are the real realities, what are the stories we're getting told, and how is this mucking with students and what they actually need?
Well, I think this will, by the nature of what you just described, going to be perhaps the first of more than one episode on the topic. I certainly congratulate you for breaking some new ground here in case of where we're going. I guess in terms of operational terms, you know, we're dialing it back. You know, the nature of learning per se in various contexts, we're actually asking some ontological questions, some epistemological questions, as in, what do we even mean when we talk about knowing something? What do we even mean when we talk about, you know, just any a priori?
I think it's
a priori. That's what we're going to go with. You know, assumptions, you know, it just re-examine all of them. Take it back to first principles. And I guess this is where I'm starting to, when I start thinking in that kind of terms, those kind of language, I'm just all in on Marcus Aurelius right now. I've been reading Meditations,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Diary of a Roman Emperor, basically, not meant ever for public consumption, but through either a, you know, good or negative or indifferent turn of the universe, somehow some pretty powerful passages about this person's inner life have resonated, you know, this far out. So besides the fact that it's
Can you share a couple that have really resonated with you?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I can probably just even go to my Instagram for that, because I've been doing so, I've been going so far as to actually, you know, taking pictures of it, just because last night, actually, I was sort of like, I'm just going to stay up all night and then just do the podcast and try and finish this book. But sleep got to me about 2 hours before we were supposed to start. So that's on me. So let's just see here. In terms of quotes, there we go. Okay, sure. Just to pick one, the most recent one here. And this is, I think it's from, he's got them divided into books, and I won't be able to say without looking deep which book
this is in.
But so someone despises me. That's their problem. Mine. Do not say anything despicable. Someone hates me. Their problem. It's like, you know, he's a guy, you know, he saw himself throughout as like the world's highest level bureaucrat. And he much would have rather, like, he says as much. He's like, you know, it's an impediment to being a philosopher that I have to be an emperor. You know, he was like, he's doing it out of he saw it as being like a function of necessity for the situation that he was in. I don't know. I just think, like, he was not impervious to being concerned about what people around him thought on a very human level. And he developed these mental routines, these sort of aphorisms within these meditations, sort of like throughout the book, is sort of like books, plural, I suppose. He's sort of saying you, right? It's written, a lot of it in the second person. So it sounds like he's talking to you as a reader, but in fact, he's actually talking to you as himself. So you kind of get a double sense of like where he's coming from there. It's very interesting. I'll just stop rambling here and let you talk, I promise. But I'll just say one more thing here before I pass the mic, is that really, I've encountered books all the time that I love, and I'm like, that's a great book. This is, you know, a really awesome book that I'll recommend to people. I'm not going to recommend this one because it's impacted in a very immediate way how I perceive and just engage with stuff around me. We can go into that more. I don't think anybody needs to hear that, but that's very unusual for me. There's only like maybe 5 books I can even think of in my life where, for very specific reasons, it's changed everything. And this is one of those times. So Yeah, Doug, that's way off in the tangents now, bud.
No, no, you're really not. Because if you take a look at the reality, like, that's your reality right now. And as a learner, that book found you.
It did.
Right? Or you found the book, whatever, however it works. I engaged with the Stoic Kindle stuff about 3.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Kindle. Jeepers creepers. It's almost like we're an education technology podcast.
I've got 20/20 vision, allegedly. But what I'm finding with my old man eyes is that, you know, just being able to increase the font size. That's major. Like, I mean, I'm going to keep collecting these artifacts, you know, these books, because I love having them in my hand. But when it comes to actually a satisfactory reading experience, I hate to say it, but this little thing from Amazon is kind of my go-to now. So go figure. I'm reading Marcus Aurelius, you know, via this Kindle tablet thingy, you know. It's I don't know. It's a postmodern situation. And anyway, man. So that was one quote. And, you know, there are others. Yeah, but.
So with that quote, though, yeah. Like that found you, and that's what you need right now, right? Like, that is what's helping inspire you, and that's where you are in your life, and all the boxes are getting ticked.
Well, it's even a matter of, like, I purposely have avoided – I've chosen to stop reading other things until I'm finished with this, because how I finish this is going to be foundational to, you know, a new understanding of everything else going after it. So, again, to me, this is unusual. I, you know, like I said, maybe 4 or 5 times ever since I was a kid, this has happened. So it's serendipitous, really, I suppose.
So how do we do that in education? How do we let these, like, that seems like a big rock that you just threw into a pond, right?
Maybe.
Like,
that's a good metaphor.
That happens first, and everything else coming after it has to deal with the ripples of what you've learned. Yeah. But are we doing that for students?
Right? Well,
you'd have to almost be a doctorate student to be working on an independent study to be able to engage that way.
Okay, so if we're going to actually steer this into the land of practical applications, which I always enjoy when we can do that.
yeah.
It's not just about scarves and, you know, high rhetoric here.
Yeah.
I would actually say that I've had some success. I wouldn't call it self-directed kind of study, you know, but I think if you kind of give students the opportunity to construct new knowledge, in whatever way, in whatever kind of pedagogical approach, then you're looking at an inquiry-based approach to teaching and learning. And as soon as you get into that inquiry-based mindset, then suddenly, you know, you can start, you know, whether it's through Google or, you know, whatever other way, you can start narrowing it down. You can start sort of focusing both on literature appropriate to your particular situation, because in the social literature, I mean, there's just it's tons of stuff. It's a very wide and varied body of academic practice, right? So anyway, man, so that's one practical aspect of it, I think. You know, we can once we sort of delineate what we're trying to do as, you know, definitely associated with community, definitely associated with inquiry. You see where I'm going with this? Community, inquiry. Yeah, maybe. Okay, so then it becomes actionable, though, because then you can start being like, okay, again, tangible examples specific to what I might be doing, whether, you know, it's in K-12 or post-secondary in whatever way. So I like how we're how you're sort of given the opportunity to kind of frame some of this stuff up. But as for some of the, I guess, underlying pedagogical constructs that we've been dealing with on the show since the beginning.
Yeah, because this leads me to the Barkan article, Sociological Theory and Educational Reality.
Yep.
Because we take a look at that, and the quote involves, despite the vast sums of money being spent on students, so many of them are coming out lacking basic skills and expression and comprehension. They were unable to speak well, write clearly, read quickly, and understand what they read. And it's like, yeah, so the system failed.
Well, okay, and that's and again, I like how what you got here is from a source that's fairly old, because I mean, again, 93 on that one, right, Barkan? So again, it sort of speaks to the fact that this may even be a problem for a generation or more than one generation of educators, right? That you have to kind of each generation of people entering the field kind of has to take this stuff on each time. Right. So,
yeah,
this is where I think the SOTL literature can, you know, provide some guidance. It can provide some, you know, shortcuts, especially for people who, you know, their expertise. Again, we've talked about this before, doesn't necessarily include a pedagogical approach. It doesn't, you know, include a B.Ed. It doesn't include teaching training as such. Right. So I think that this can be very helpful. Yeah.
So with SOTL, though, just in case you have listeners that aren't up on that, that's Scholarship for Teaching and Learning? That's
Pardon me. SOTL? Yeah, absolutely, Carl. Okay. Absolutely, right? And, you know, this isn't it gets associated with teaching and learning centers a lot in higher ed, and rightfully so, because that's where a lot of this stuff originates. But I think, actually, for anybody, you know, who's interested, you know, K to 12 or whatever, this kind of, again, these accounts of practice are there to be had in various ways. So, you know, again, just framing it up every generation is kind of cool here, right?
Right. And SOTL is a pretty new concept, right? Like when I was at NAET in like 2008 or 2009 or something, I think it was 2008, that's when they started getting into SOTL. I helped set up the first committee or group or whatever they ended up calling it to bring people together and say, hey, let's talk about teaching and learning, right? Because I haven't gone and looked for the older literature, but it's not 20 years old. I don't remember seeing anything like that. Have you?
No, it's true. No, man. Again, I've got my name on a couple of multi-authored peer-reviewed things from when I was at my role before TRU. So we're talking Ontario Tech University, when I was in a full-on, you know, teaching center role, which, looking back on it, man, again, it's like, you don't know, the grass is always greener, something like that. But it was like, this is, we're talking in that case, like 2015, and at which point, you know, that was like, okay, there's this whole area that I was hitherto unaware of, probably in my role prior to that, but it gave me the opportunity to kind of jump into that sort of thing with both feet. And again, when you see somebody being successful, maybe or more successful, having a higher sense of self-efficacy in what they're doing, which is ultimately as good a marker of success as in teaching as I can think of, in, you know, just, you could, seeing that stuff work, it's like, okay, it's not just, you know, a slogan. It's like there's actually, you know, through working with somebody and bringing in some stuff from the literature, you can actually have a successful thing. That was my first kind of experience with that, right, during those years. So, yeah, man, this is all good stuff, I think. Hopefully I'm not too far in the weeds here, dude.
No, just the opposite, because I was going to make comments, and then you had that last little bit, and that goes right to the Zaluska Zubrick article, like teacher strategies, professional activities for the conditions of neoliberal educational reality, right? Like you talk about that, right? And it's like there's a bunch of teacher deprofessionalization that's happening, and they've analyzed a bunch of stuff, and teachers paid more attention to implementing core curriculum, and they spent less time on the interest and cognitive needs of the students.
Okay, core curriculum. That to me is, again, neoliberal jargon, isn't it?
I think the word neoliberal is jargon.
Okay, so fair enough. I'll say that. It's one of those things that's been sloganized. Like, what are you even really saying when you mean that? But I'll just say, if I'm sort of going back to my Paulo Freire, pedagogy of the heart, pedagogy of the oppressed, again, the commentaries there have actually, I mean, you know, you can see the commentaries and you can actually see an informed use of that term. But you're right. I'm just kind of bandying it around. But I do feel like core curriculum, it's one of those things like what? Like, it makes me think of No Child Left Behind. It makes me think of like some odious context-free teaching, basically, which I think is kind of problematic a lot. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, you know, it's benign. But
maybe, but I don't think it is. And I think that's part of the struggle that we're having with educational realities right now. Because as we make the move to, we need different sets of skills, right? It's not about you have the knowledge. It's okay, or you have the information. It's how do I use it? And how do I decide what's good and what's not? And with, like, it's all out there, right? If I want to know something, I'll go to Google or I'll go to ChatGPT and they'll give me answers, but I need to figure out if they're any good. And are we doing enough to help the students with that new reality, right? Like I'm looking at some curriculums, like the new curriculum that's got pushed into place in Alberta, right? Some of that stuff is out of the 1950s and it's out of Tennessee in the 1950s. So it's, are we looking at the curriculum or are we looking at students? We've made the move to care more about cognition because back in the 70s and 80s, it wasn't about cognition. It was learn these facts. And then there was the big rebellion because like, oh, no, we want the students to think more. So that was a generational shift. And now we're at the point where, okay, they're thinking, but where do we head now? And it's the where are we heading now that seems to be lost in the weeds and in a lot of this.
Well, that's awesome, man. I'll just say that I think
it's all good. It's all good.
My throat's trying to catch up with what my mind was trying to formulate.
This
is like, you're talking about generational shift. So, I mean, I came into the field, you know, 2006 to 2007, 2008, thereabouts, from when I started to being finished my B.Ed. and getting into my M.Ed. and stuff. And in those education degrees, I don't know if it's like my particular institutions or programs or what, but like from the day we walked in, it's like we're doing something called constructivism here. And it was just, that was it, you know? And it's like, it wasn't de rigueur. It wasn't like, you know, some arbitrary thing, but it was like, here's a larger thing that you can take your experiences and planning and use it as a guide to sort of frame what you're doing. So this is where instructional design and curriculum are actually really compelling fields for me because you're sort of, you know, getting to do some things within the learning environment to, you know, structural things in terms of content, in terms of format, and providing opportunities within there for, you know, collaboration, generation of new knowledge. And again, you start talking about now you go from something sort of abstract, like, well, you know, constructivism, what even is that? But you can follow a chain from that terminology into very, very specific practices relative to your situation. You don't have to follow, you don't have to go through too many clicks on the internet to get from one to the other, I don't think.
Yes. So that's.
I'm just rambling. This is me just rambling.
But when we go there, especially with the technology component, it is the couple of clicks. Like, what books would I have to go to the library and find and read to try to, instead of those clicks that are like, oh yeah, that's interesting. Click, 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 click.
Well, okay. So, well, fair enough. So, and this is where I think there are some pretty good general resources out there. So talking about teaching in a digital age, right? The number of books that have come out teaching in a digital age. I don't want to just try and flail on the guy's name.
No, for sure.
Right, Tony Bates. There we go. I said George Siemens or something, I would just be like, you know, I'd have to, you know, go back and do a lot of editing on this clip, basically. But Tony Bates, okay, so he, Teaching in a Digital Age, Guidelines for Designing, Teaching, and Learning. So it's sort of learning design vis-a-vis, you know, some of, you know, the technological format, but he does it, you know, he and I suppose his collaborators do it in such a way that it's very non-academic jargon filled, right? It's meant to be as accessible right. as possible to the widest number of people. So we're talking about, you know, maybe that's not going to give you your exact prescription for your class, but it's going to sort of mediate between this very wide and diverse body of literature and practice and distill it into some, you know, key kinds of points, right, to follow up on. It's kind of, I don't know, it's not a recipe book as such, but it's sort of for the general practitioner, I suppose.
You just brought up a fantastic concept. Okay. I know people that they hate the recipe books, and I don't. Because, like, when I'm in the kitchen, I need a recipe, right? It's sometimes that's where I need to start. I need to start with this much of this, this much of that, then do this thing. And I don't know why some people turn their nose up at the recipe book kind of concepts.
Well, again, it's you know, it's what your metaphors are. It comes down to two. I mean, what, you know, the prevailing culture, you know, is willing to allow, willing to accept. And that depends so often on interpersonal factors, inter-office relationships, and, you know, all the rest of it, right? Everything that goes on in the academic industry. So the academic industry, I went there.
Yep.
But, you know, so I think we're opening up here. But again, I just kind of want to, like, again, shout out to my man Marcus Aurelius, because, you know, at an advanced age, right, he's like, he's in his 50s. You know, he's not living the life back in the palace. He's like on the front, you know, where the Germanic tribes have been. You know, he spent most of his time basically dealing with insurgency, trying to quash this stuff at the edge of the borders. He's considered, you know, the last of the five good emperors. And there's some stuff in the books where he's like, you know, don't allow yourself to get too hung up on external events, i.e. the Christians. Like, i.e. the Christians. He's like, mental note, don't get too hung up on these little pesky dudes. Well, guess what? And but he kept going back to his first principles. Like, what do I mean by reality? I mean, he doesn't use that word. He talks more about the logos, right? The logos, the composition of the universe. And it's, you know, the terminology may be different, but, you know, he keeps going back to his first principles to remind himself what he's about, even though he's got, you know, literally the world at his feet. He just keeps digging back in and reminding himself who he is and what he's about. So I think that's kind of one of the cool things about this show. You know, we keep kind of getting to bring in some of these things, keep exploring them, navigating back. And there's a lot of interesting through lines that I think we've been, you know, able to address thus far within this endeavor. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And what I feel bad about is I love the Stoic stuff. I dug into that a couple of years ago.
Yep.
And again, it's the Marcus Aurelius kept coming back to his home base. Like, this is my reality. This is who I am as a person, his core.
It was inside. He was unassailable. He's like, all this right. stuff is just ephemera. Everything's going to be dust. You start out as dust. You're here for about 2 seconds, not even 2 seconds. He keeps reminding himself, like, if you ever question what you're up to, remind yourself of the vastness of time before you and the vastness of time after. And that in itself is a good remedy for a lot of what will ail you, because you're just, you know, the only thing you can do, if there's some sort of, you know, predetermined outcome, it's going to happen regardless. So chill. And, you know, the only thing you can do is just live a good life, you know, to the best of your function. Now, the Stoics are terrible on slavery, right? That's just one of those things where it's just like, slavery, I'm just living with it. It's a thing, you know. And then also this guy, his son ended up being like just this wretched, terrible tyrant, this complete psychopath. And he's just like, you know, he lost 12 kids. I'm just rambling here, dude. This is my report about Marcus Aurelius. He went through all this horrible trauma for your summer vacation.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, like, this is just like,
It's right there, man. It's right out the front of your brain. So yeah, keep going.
I'm navigating these concepts vis-a-vis, you know, the most recent thing I read. I don't know, man. I think I've probably done that enough justice for now.
No, but you have so much enthusiasm for it, right? Like, you've engaged with it. This is going to be an important book for the rest of your life, right? You're going to touch base on this stuff. Why aren't we dealing with that reality and, like, your excitement and my excitement with it back a few years ago? Are we doing anything like that in the K-12 or post-secondary systems now? Like, where does that engagement happen, right? Because we both found that because we needed it, or whatever, the universe brought it to us. However we found it, are those experiences happening in the organized education systems?
I think there's pockets of innovation, again, to use kind of a hackneyed term, but across any institution that I've worked at, you know, in whatever setting,
whatever.
My career began, I mean, there's always people trying new, cool things. You know, whether it's ad hoc, you know, initiatives sort of on their own, or whether maybe it's through pilots or supported initiatives. It seems like, you know, the creativity, the drive, I mean, it could be, you know, as far as, you know, my previous thing, it may just be that I wasn't passionate enough about the thing within that context. It may, you know, be one of the reasons why there was a sort of a fissure there. I mean, I'm not really going back to just like, well, what went wrong? You know, I'm not doing that. It's just more like, you know, you try and think about, you know, how certain things manifested, right? So it's like, I have a lot of enthusiasm for this. And I'm realizing now that had I not, you know, started this, had we not begun this podcast, this initiative back last year, and with the punk one, you know, the other one with my good friend Dan, like, these things wouldn't exist had things not gone that way at TRU that they did. And I've been telling my parents and stuff. I mean, for me, these are just two very significant creative outlets that, you know, it wouldn't have manifested in this way. And I'm glad that it is manifesting in this way, you know, so that kind of helps, you know, move things forward. So just to bring it really back, because I think I have a through line here, is that, you know, how do we, to speak to your question, how do we bring our individual passions to bear, or how can we have, you know, more of this kind of engagement? Just put in the opportunities to your students, because your students will, I think, respond. And if your students are, say, other professionals, even in a professional development setting, it starts with having the higher concept of what you're trying to achieve, and then having a clear linkage between pedagogy and strategy, right? And this is where your helpful teaching and learning centers and your SOTA literature can sort of provide some guidance there, right? Making that from showing that linkage between, say, a learning outcome and a learning activity and an assessment. You know, you get your little, those grids and sheets and stuff like that from the teaching center, man. Love the teaching centers, folks. Love them.
That should be a standard disclaimer. We like,
I think so.
We like teaching and learning centers. Yeah.
Well, I don't have to change the end slides here too much sometimes, because I'm just like, oh, just the references, same references. Good, good. I mentioned once, I get to keep the slide. But okay. So, dude. If I haven't driven us too far astray here,
no, you haven't. You haven't. It's. What I really got excited about was when I started to do the exploring with my knowledge of Cuba, and it was just because I happened to be there. And, like, the experiences that you and I have had are pretty similar to what a lot of people have had.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like, you look at what's going on with the economy right now. It's even those jokes we made, like, 12 episodes ago, where it's like, hey, did you notice a whole lot of Batman villains have graduate degrees, right? It's that kind of stuff. I don't think the curriculum is keeping up to date with the real realities of what we're doing. And if you, like, you take a look at the industry that is post-secondary, we are pumping out six people with doctorates for every one academic position.
Oh, yeah.
Canada.
Unsustainable. Unsustainable.
Yeah. So it's 6-1. And it's like, well, then why couldn't the doctorates be more about, here's how to not be in academia, but go into other things? And it's just not. That reality is not happening.
Right. So, again, there may be a rupture, if you will, between, you know, what the educational services are providing vis-a-vis dispersal of tax dollars through a, you know, state delivery kind of system for public education, K-12 and you know, higher ed. So, you know, when we think about it that way, it's just like, oh, it's just a bureaucratic process. Wonderful. Subject to political thrones and whims. And this is where, and I've mentioned this before, we talked about this before, where the whole ed tech field suddenly becomes very fraught because it deals with things like procurement and it deals with things like budget processes, in as much as we're subscribing to the software package for X number, you know, FTEs across the university, and this is how much it's going to cost, and here are the so-called benefits and whatnot. So it just becomes so fraught. You can't just start with the teaching aspect of it because everybody who pays for it isn't necessarily looking at it that way. The last thing I'll just say is what you keep reminding me of, you know, you mentioned a couple times about just people being adequately prepared. I think it comes to this notion of digital and cultural literacies that we've been advocating for here. And again, when I talk literacy, I am dealing with Freire, you know, in as much as that was kind of his stepping point with his initial kind of work in and among, you know, people with less political agency, right? Because, you know, thought is predicated on language. Some people debate the chicken and egg relationship there, but it's pretty clear that once you can express a thought, you know, externally vis-a-vis literacy, then suddenly you have political agency, you know, 100% more than otherwise, right? So,
along those lines, you tied me in nicely to my last bit of literature, so thank you for that. I'm going to jump to that in a sec.
Thank you for not accusing me of rambling.
You're the only one that accuses you of rambling. Don't do that. No, I like where you're headed. And with the problem is I'm going to go off on a tangent right now about the language.
Please do.
Stuff.
Yeah.
The word blue, like the color blue, they can't. I've done some looking into this, and people are saying that they can't find any record of blue being a color 500 years ago. Like, nobody used that word. It was whatever. They had all the other words to describe it. And now blue's kind of my favorite color a bunch. So it's, how do people use that? And I had some nurse friends in Alberta, and they had somebody come over from England who was a nurse, and they couldn't understand the words that they were using to describe things. Like, apparently, like, every time they do a lot of recording, right? Nurses do a pile of writing down and taking notes. And one lady was like, the previous nurse said the wound looked angry. What does that mean? Right? And they had to figure out what angry meant. And it's because that was a standard term that everybody knew in UK hospitals. And yeah, angry meant X, Y, and Z. And in Alberta, they weren't using it the same way. So,
and again, just what you're speaking to now, in terms of practical issues, we're talking about international credential recognition as being very problematic across Canada, I think. You know, it's like we open the gates to people from all over the world. And that's, and I'm not saying that in any kind of derogatory manner. It's like, this is to our benefit, I think. But, you know, it's the story of, you know, it's the same story. You know, everybody's had that thing, I think, where you get into Pearson or you get into a major airport and it's late at night and you get into the taxi and, you know, you start chatting with, you know, the person who, you know, may, you know, be from another country. And it's like, yeah, you know, I'm a surgeon back home. It's like, it's taken me 4 years to do this, or, you know, like I'm an engineer. I've been picked up, you know, by engineers a few times, and they're just like, I'm just here because, you know, my kids are going to have a better life or whatnot. So, you know, there's this whole recognizing, you know, credentialing across, you know, industries from outside, but as well, I don't know. I think we could be doing a lot better about a lot more to bring people in. I don't know how I started talking about immigration here, dude, as much as I did. So
that
should
be another podcast.
Maybe
that should be another podcast. I'm going to go to the last reference that I have, the Manov et al. Article, the Digital Aspects of Modern Society and Education Realities.
Oh, yes.
Because when we, there was a chart there, and I'm a big fan of charts, and it
talks
about, it's a bunch of digital divide stuff. We're back to the digital divide as we talk about the realities that we're dealing with. And way back before I started talking about the color blue and nurses and stuff, you had made a point about how this is part of the move that we're making. The problem is part of the real reality is there's a pile of the population that's getting cut out of that. So again, we come back to the same problem of who is actually included and who's excluded, right? Like if you're illiterate, good luck trying to use a bunch of these apps, right, on the phone. Or if you're an older population, have you ever tried to teach somebody how to double tap on a phone? If it's like, oh, this is painful. Like, oh, like this is really beat my head against the wall painful. And I've been in theater my whole life.
Some people shine in those situations, Doug. That's just, you know, that may just be kind of us kind of having our, I hear you and I know what you mean. It's, but I do like this bar chart. I have to say it's like a 3D bar chart.
Yeah.
You're going to be impressed. And okay, and this is even, and this from 2020, so this is like late 2020. So this is
brand new,
brand spanking new. This stuff here.
And when we take a look at this stuff, it's holy moly, we have a reality going on right now in the world and in our education systems. And these are the people. Look at the number of people that what are they using to do their learning or do their interacting outside of that. And if we're leaving a bunch of people behind, why? Right? Why?
Well, I'm looking at this document now, and you got this really awesome quote by Alvin Toffler. The illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. You've thrown that into the notes previously, have you not, Doug? I feel like I've seen that particular one before, or maybe it just resonates so well that it feels like it does.
Part of my digital clutter was I found a list of these that I have saved.
Awesome.
We've done the talk about this.
Yeah.
But I'm kicking myself because I didn't find it for the last episode on unlearning.
Oh well, we're gonna be spinning back to that periodically anyway. I think it's kind of baked into the nature of what the show is about at this point. To be determined if we're still at that, you know, a certain point from now. But well, okay, so again, going back to our first principles, how are we even defining literacy? I like that. This kind of draws us back into what do we even mean by, you know, these key terms, right? How are we thinking of that? So, again, I just would like to say that, you know, in terms of going back to what we mean by these kind of terms, reminding ourselves that they're context specific a lot of the time. It's up to, I think, incumbent upon anybody in an educational role to hopefully have the cognitive tools, conceptual tools, to be able to make some use of these practices.
And the problem is they also need the technical tools and the technical access.
Right. You can't just take it for granted that people are coming in with universal or anywhere close to a standard set of knowledge, right? Which I think speaks to the process. We talked about this before about, you know, one in terms of a practical thing, you know, building in maybe some learning to learn in university kind of training, learning to learn in college. I mean, call it academics 101 if you want to, but where, you know, you actually, you know, just like, here's how to do the effective Google search. Here's what Google Scholar even is. I mean, just basic, I mean, what we would call basic strategies for information searches, you know, writing, academic, you know, does this make a lick of sense here, bud?
Do you know how ticked off people get when they find these things out later? Like I, like, sorry, I, it sounded like a question, but it wasn't a question. I'm going to tell you. I was teaching the second year education class.
Yep.
And the students were complaining about, we had the librarian in to show them how to do how to write up their literature and stuff. And she said, okay, yeah, the website kind of works. Do this, do that, do the other thing. And then when she left, I said, do not do that literature thing that the librarian said. I said, go to Google Scholar. And they're like, what's that? And so then I went to Google Scholar and I showed them, and here's how you do this and here's how you do that. And one guy was choked. He's like, this is my third year. How come nobody told me this in high school? This would have saved me so much time. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm telling you now. So,
well, and with all due respect to our librarian colleagues, we wouldn't say throw it out as such. It's like, here's something else we can add to this, right? Here's this whole other level and layer of navigating the open web in whatever way, in addition to, you know, these other kinds of resources. So again, just kind of, you know, even yes. like just note, like just giving everybody sort of a basic entry point into what scholarship even is across disciplines. One of my former colleagues, she's not a former colleague. She's at Ontario Tech University, and she does like social sciences, but she teaches them within the health science department. So it's like she's in this situation where she's teaching like social epidemiology of illness and causes and effects and all these social determinants of health. And they're just like, I'm going to be a radiation tech. Why do I need this? And it's just, you know, it's just a perpetual thing. She has tenure now, so it doesn't really matter. Way to go, Toba, 5 years ago for getting tenure. But it's still, you know, it's just like helping people have, you know, people don't always want what's good for them. And who am I to say what's good for them, right? Who am I? Nobody, that's who. But I don't know. There's got to be some.
You have a terminal degree in this. You are Dr. Matt. You know some stuff.
I put myself out there in enough different situations and settings that I'd like to think that I may have an insight, which hopefully may be of benefit to somebody else. Because otherwise, what the hell am I even doing? Really, you know. So.
Yes.
Well, cool beans, man. And you got the illustrations here.
I just
didn't want
you to be too hard on yourself.
I have what would Marcus be thinking right now? He's not, you know, he's like, literally, some of the language that he's in there, it's just so evocative. He's like, basically, you know, you're a bag of sinews stuck to a spine. And, you know, your mind is all that's separating you from that just being like a bag of sticks and, you know, just raggedy phlegm and whatever else. And you're only here for like an atomic second, not even an atom of a second. So what do you do with it? Try and do the right thing. How do I know what the right thing is? Well, again, first principles, whatever. Everything that the mind needs is within the mind, as a starting point. And again, sometimes it's like, you've read this stuff. I don't mean to keep sort of just be like, here's my book report about meditations, you know, but it's just, again, you talk about things that are kind of affecting you lately. So I'm saying I'm not being too hard on myself. I'm just like looking at this within the context of, you know, my latest brain worm, you know.
Now, if you take a look at that concept, right, the Marcus Aurelius concept, the last image that I shared, the change is possible image. Right, and it talks about decades of mistakes and the slow roll of improvement. It's like, we can make change, we can make it better, but first we have to decide to.
I'm reminded of Sisyphus. That looks like a Sisyphusian image, you know, the pushing the ball, condemned to push the rock all the way to the top, and then it rolls back down. But
I'm hoping
that
the bridge is flat.
Okay.
And that they're just rolling stuff out of the way and it's not up one side and down the other.
Well, can I just say here, you've got a couple of Dilberts in here, dude. So
yeah.
Can you speak to the Dilberts? please. We're on the downward side of this, I think, at this point. Oh. So
the Dilberts I harvested like 20 years ago. I do not own
Dilbert. I love it. You told me about this, whether I don't know if it was recording or not, but you're just like, I basically have Google folders full of things that I collect. And you're like,
I got these
quotes, you know, and now you got these cartoons. You got this whole kit, man. I do have to actually check out your mega folder structure or whatever, because I think there's probably some cool nuggets in there, such as,
You know, in June or whenever for the Selly conference, absolutely.
Do we get accepted for that?
Not yet. They said the deadline was the 17th, but then they told the
they don't get enough. They always extend it because they don't get enough call. They don't get enough. I remember conferences. I remember how this stuff works. June live in PEI. Maybe a preview of some programming. We've talked about it. You know, where Doug, you mentioned it sort of after the, you know, once the recording was over last time, we were sort of hashing this out. And you're like, yeah, we can both do the podcast at my place. Like, you know, but we'll, you know, so as opposed to, you know, the distance based thing. So any chance to add some variety to the format here, folks, is what we're after, honestly.
Well, yeah, we're learning. So let's try it. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, okay, we learned. Let's do something different. Let's not do that again.
You know, I feel like we've really covered off a lot here. And again, what I enjoy about the show, one of the things, is that, you know, we start out on these pretty wide or, you know, problematically kind of topics because, again, with the inquiry mode of education, which I think we're both supportive of. And then we end up just kind of busting open all this kind of terrain, you know, here and there, wherein it's like, you know, there's this other stuff we can kind of keep coming back to. At some point, it would be actually worthwhile to do a transcript of each of these recordings and like start doing like thematic analyses and sort of, you know, pinning it down the terms that we're using and stuff. And actually go full on academic with this, which I think is what you've been talking about kind of since the get go, right, bud?
Oh yeah.
This podcast is in itself an act of sottle, or maybe.
Yes.
Freaking
right, it is. Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of the reality which we're trying to bring forward here, you know,
there's a little Dilbert strip from 2002. And the pointy-haired boss says, it's a new reality. If you don't like it, you can leave. Right? And what happens is Dilbert asks a question about blah, 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 blah. And then everybody else in the room is asleep. It's like, oh, never mind. Apparently everybody else knew what you meant. And this is what's happening in some classrooms. It's the students can't leave. They don't have that option to get out, right? It's not like they can quit and go someplace else. They can't. But we've lost them all. Everybody else is asleep because whatever crud they're covering, nobody cares. Doesn't matter.
Well, again, there's a case to be made where, you know, it's almost never the case that the content is wrong. It's just that, you know, a pedagogical approach doesn't align with it in a way that's motivating or dynamic or engaging. And you can go, well, maybe that doesn't necessarily need to be there. And it's fine. You know, teachers can go in and clock their clock and students can go in and just sort of get those marks on their transcript. But if you are actually serious about trying to have it as something more substantive, something more meaningful, something that teaches, you know, literacy and metacognitive skill, which will be useful across, you know, all those other contexts, if that's what you're after, you know, something a bit more real, then, you know, there are ways to go about that, right? So,
and that perfectly guides me to the Einstein quote I threw in. Education is what remains after one has forgotten everything he learned in school. It is a miracle that curiosity survives formal education. You just walked me right to that door. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having the door there to be walked to in the first place. So what we got here? We got the word of the podcast.
And it's reality. And you want to know what a nightmare it is to search for education and reality? 99% of the stuff is virtual reality. Like, it's all about the technological virtual reality of it. It's like, no, it's not virtual. Just actual reality. I got a little frustrated when I was searching.
We're talking about the philosophical underpinnings of the enterprise, sir or madam.
That is exactly what I was looking for.
That's right.
And I needed full text versions of things so I could actually read the article first. So,
I'm looking forward to working at an institution again. I don't know if I'm going to work at an institution again, but having that institutional access to the library, man, that's some good stuff too, right? But
it really does. And okay, now I have is just a little question at the end for people. Is it was going to be like, is curriculum and teaching in school keeping up with reality? And I hate that I made it a yes, no question, because then it's easy to answer. It's yes or no.
Well, okay. I know what you mean. It's like, it's a maybe in construction, it may be a lower format, you know, but I think actually that's a bit of there's an implicit, it looks more simple than it is. It's like, if you just want to answer yes or no to that, then fine, you can engage with it in that way in as much as you are formulating a yes or no response. But if you have a certain critical faculty, then you may go, hey, wait a minute, this isn't really a yes, no question. So you puzzle it out a little bit more. Again, some ill-defined learning opportunities within that kind of presentation, dude. So in my opinion.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for giving me the benefit of the doubt on that. I was just kicking myself I was still on holiday brain. When I wrote that question, and it was like, oh man,
I'm on unemployed brain, dude. And, it's, you know, and I've been at that longer than you were on vacation. So,
I think you're still self-employed. I still think 506 Productions.
Yes. Thank you. 506 Consulting Limited. Thank you.
Oh, 506 Consulting. Sorry. I thought it was 506 Production.
506 Consulting Limited. 506 Productions could be sort of, within the, larger umbrella, the larger corporate umbrella. I'm a reliable person and you should hire me if you're listening to this. Anyway, but seriously, Doug, you know, we're kind of being pretty silly and self-deprecating here. You know, but that's kind of what we normally do on the show anyway, I think, to a degree. But I just like to say, man, thanks a lot for the interesting topic, just because I do my ridiculous things on social media. But when I saw, you know, the topic, I'm like, this actually is a chance to, you know, speak to some of this stuff that's on my reading list right now. So as ever, I appreciate the opportunity. And I think we've got a whole lot of further areas we can go with this, dude, honestly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to pander to the audience a little and say, if anybody can point me in the direction of a book about the history of Cuba that isn't very communist good, capitalist bad.
A good, well-rounded contemporary history of Cuba.
I would love to know. I would love to explore that a little further. So
dope.
But that's all I got for today. So
well, and same here. Always a pleasure, bud. I'll end the recording, but folks, we appreciate you checking this out in whatever format. We are really, you know, even if you're just checking in for a few minutes, even just once ever, it's awesome that you're here. We really appreciate it. So thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, bye for now.
Have a good one.